When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan Itlquencha Sachs. Ethan, I loathe that this card is in the format. Absolutely loathe it.
Okay, so I know you are predisposed to...
Yes, to loathe Quench. I am predisposed, for sure.
That's lore for the podcast, like, you know, Mana Tithe, Force Spike, Daze, like... All of those little, if only I had one more mana, two more mana kind of cards have always irked you. So is your loathing of this card in this format anything more than that?
Yeah, because I think it's good, but it's very situationally good. Like sometimes it's also really bad. So it's frustrating that it is not only... good and you're supposed to play it, but that also when you're playing it, sometimes it's atrocious. It's got a very wide band of possible outcomes when you put it in your deck or when your opponent has it.
Yeah, all of that makes me be like, I like that it's in the format. Like, I like that I have to think about it. I like that, like, I feel like I'm signing up sometimes when I play my thing. Okay, no, he's not happy.
Thinking about it is not good because you have to jam into it so much because the format's quick. Like, you can't just afford to not play your good five drop because they might have Itlquencha. You jam and cross your fingers, and then you're very angry when they have it.
Yes, sure. Yes, I agree, I guess. Except, like, maybe there were things earlier in the game that, like, clued you into it, and maybe you decided to do something different. I'm saying if that's your only play that you have to make, you make the play, and if they have Itlquencha, they have Itlquencha. But, like, I don't know. So they have a removal spell for your thing. I don't know. This does not bother me that much. We're starting off on the wrong foot.
Way worse than a removal spell. Way worse than a removal spell. You need to teach me how to get to your Quench Zen state because I don't know.
We had a lovely opportunity yesterday to stream a little bit together. We piloted. I mostly was just, you know, heckling you while you piloted a deck to a trophy, and then we did a draft together, which was the easiest draft ever. Where I was hoping to be like, "Ooh, how are our picks going to line up?" And then you just got like the nuts Dimir deck. You helped me draft a deck that was actually quite interesting. It was like a lower powered Azorius deck. Pack three was quite kind though. But then we even had like some. How do you build this? Do you put in the first time flyers and some more lessons? Do you cut that package? Do you keep the curve a little higher? Do you lower the curve? Like, we had a lot of interesting decisions there. And I was expecting us to not be lined up in some spots, but I felt like we were pretty lockstep in terms of our overall approach and how we were approaching packs and the draft. And so that let me feel good about joining you on the pod today in terms of us being lockstep with these notes. But one of the things I did notice when we were streaming together is you play scared. Everything is, anytime your opponent interacts with you, you're like, well, that's it. That's it for me. It's curtains. It's curtains for Team Wernie.
Yeah, I was traumatized by this format early on. I've since come to a place of acceptance and love for it. But the first 2 days of this format, I've played this format a ton, way more than I normally would have because I was very sick on Wednesday. I left school halfway through the day. And so I just played Magic all day Wednesday because what else are you going to do while you're sick? And then stayed home Thursday and played Magic all day Thursday because I was homesick. But I was sick, so I was kind of miserable, and I was just jamming over and over and over again, trying to figure out the format. But I lost a lot, and not badly. I just couldn't trophy. I would constantly like 3-3, 4-3, 5-3 with decks that I thought should and could trophy. And then every once in a while in there, I derailed into, well, this deck's not good enough. Let me try Shrines and see if that works, or let me try whatever. And I 0-3'd or 1-3'd a couple times, but that was more just due to frustration and tilt than anything else. But since then, I have resolved to tightening up my gameplay. I think that was the biggest leak for me. The games are hard in this format. They're complicated, and I think you have to think and you have to work to beat some of the really good rares that are out there. And since I have doubled down on, I'm going to play tight, I'm going to draft tight, I've been doing fine, trophied several times, and, you know, feel good about the format. It is not, I think, the format for me, but I think it is a very good format. I think the mechanics are great. I think the gameplay is excellent. My note about why it's not for me is that I think the games are a little too swingy for my taste. Like the games oftentimes have multiple big swings, and the games that don't have some of those bomb rares that come down that are very interactive and very tight, I really like those games. But the games where it's like, I play a Haymaker, I feel like I'm going to win. Nope. You play a Haymaker, you feel like you're going to win. I play another. Like, there's some games like that too. And I don't really enjoy playing that kind of Magic.
Yeah. There are times where an Azula, like the Dimir Azula, comes down and you feel like, I can beat this. There are times when the Azula comes down and you go, I lose the game right now. And then there are times when the Azula comes down and you like sit up in your chair and you're like, okay, I think I can do this. I think I can, but it is going to require me to put all of my focus on the decisions I'm making for the rest of this game. And that can be I think like the first time that happens, that's fun. That's exciting. The seventh time that happens, it's exhausting. And so yeah, the fatigue there is real.
I think one of the things I would say about this format is it's difficult to win games and it's very easy to lose games. Like, it's really easy to just lose games.
Yes. Games that you can win.
Yes.
You're like, oh, I actually threw this two turns ago because I didn't do X with my firebending mana or whatever. Okay. So a nice little teaser there. We got tons to talk about with this format after week one. A lot to discuss, a lot of updates with our thoughts and approaches. We'll certainly do big picture. We'll do individual cards. Hopefully we'll have time to get to a draft log, but be our usual sort of week one info dump here on the pod. A little housekeeping stuff before we get into that. Chat about the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited, is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. The show will always be free, but we have some great perks over at the Patreon page if you want to check those out. Two that we always want to shout out. One is access to our Discord, which is popping this week. I was diving into all of the, I've been checking Big Picture, I've been checking card evals, I've been checking the trophy channel for Avatar The Last Airbender, which is always great to get outside, or not outside, it's inside because it's our Discord, but outside of my own brain, thoughts and feelings and pulse checks about the format. So that's great to be in a community of like-minded limited individuals. Ari Lax coming out with, he was basically writing articles in our Discord, I felt like. I was here for it. I was happy to see it. I was like, the wheels are turning for this guy for what's going on in the set. And that was sweet. And the other thing we want to shout out about our Patreon is on a higher tier, you have access to our podcast feed, which gives you access to this show a day early ad-free and also our weekly bonus episode of Lords Unlimited. So if any or all of that sounds of interest to you, head on over to the Patreon page. And we want to shout out our new patrons the first week that they joined. So this week we're welcoming in Mark, David, Tho, Quinn, and Gavin. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Yep, can't say thank you enough.
Okay, you alluded to this a little bit already. There's a lot of game-defining rares in this format. And that has been my experience as well. And some of them I feel like I enjoy interacting with, and some of them I don't.
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of bombs. That's coming into it. You just need to know that that's part of what you're signing up for. It feels very March of the Machine-esque to me in that way. Like, I think that's the closest comp to this format I can find. And I did enjoy March of the Machine, and I'm coming around on this one compared to, I think, where I started initially, certainly. And a lot of that was probably due to being sick and just jamming over and over and over again while I was sick.
Yeah. And to be clear, like, I mean, I'm very pro, I think bombs and rares that like shape your draft are good for limited in terms of they make drafts more replayable. I think that is a pro. I think the sort of range of them in terms of the interactability, like Azul is a really good example, I think, of one that's like, as I said, there's three different modes of it. There's one where it's like, I can't beat this. There's one where it's like, oh, I definitely can beat this. And then there's the middle ground of like, I could buckle up and I could maybe do it with some airbending, etc. But then there's stuff like United Front. That's the X, white, white, make X allies and then put a counter on each creature you control. Like, it's, that attacks the game at a totally different axis. And I feel like inevitability, or not inevitability, but just like the duration of games means you're more likely to see those cards, and they exist on so many different axes that it's hard to be like, well, if an Azula comes down, I could deal with that. But if a United Front comes, that's going to be hard to deal with, etc. And so I feel like it's hard to arm your deck with all of the tools to combat all of those kinds of scenarios.
Yeah, you just can't. I think most often, if you're struggling in the format, the best advice, like the quick hit that I would give somebody who's struggling, is your deck needs to be able to be proactive and interactive. And not necessarily that it has to be aggressive, like you don't have to be playing Fire Nation Cadets on turn one necessarily, although that is a good strategy. But you have to be able to have creatures that can attack if the board is clear and block if the board is not clear. And you have to be able to interact with your opponent's cards. I think those two things are pretty key to the format.
Yes, I agree.
So lots of game-defining rares, lots of game-defining mythics. There are a few game-defining uncommons as well. We shouted some of these out last week, but Team Avatar has continued to go up for me. This is 2 and a white for the enchantment. Whenever a creature you control attacks alone, it gets +X/+X until end of turn, where X is the number of creatures you control. And then you can pay 2 and a white, discard it as a buyout clause to deal damage equal to the number of creatures you control to target creature. But the reason this is so good, not only is it just the abyss sometimes, but there's a lot of creatures that can become unblockable. This is a quick way to cheat games in a hurry. And I think cheating games is a very good way to win them when you're playing against an opponent with better cards than you. And I think Team Avatar lets you do that very well.
And I think that there are some, I mean, you'd mentioned the abyss, but the way the abyss comes about, the way you get your opponent to be chump blocking every turn, if they can, if you're doing it with like a 1/1 ally, is you can board stall in this format. Like it does, like, because if both players are, you know, signing up for the rules of engagement of what you're saying of being proactive and interactive, the board can stall out with a bunch of, you know, 3/3s and 1/1 allies and whatever. And that card lets you go, okay, cool, I get to punch through on a different axis.
Correct. Or I have my one flyer and you only have 2 flying chump blockers and I'm going to win in a few turns, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just very good. Iroh's Demonstration is another one. And I don't know that this is a game defining card. It can be sometimes. 1 and a red, sorcery lesson. And you choose one, it either deals 1 to each creature your opponent's control, which is often the game defining mode, and then deals 4 damage to target creature. But the fact that sometimes this just single handedly wins you the game on an uncommon is very nice and very good, because sometimes your opponents are playing a bunch of X1s and you just sweep 4 things off the battlefield and can win pretty easily from there.
Yep.
These next two, I'm pretty proud, made these show notes pre-looking at the data and was pleased to see both of these at the top of the data after feeling that they were game defining. So this is Soka, Lateral Strategist. What?
I'm chuckling because the data lines up with what you think, you're proud of yourself.
It's fine. Yeah.
Data doesn't line up with what you think, it's not,
yeah,
it's,
who cares,
children
it's
are
wrong.
Yeah,
yeah, okay, absolutely. Great. Fake news. Okay. You got
I'm
it.
Just sort of making sure we're all clocking that for our listeners at home.
Absolutely. I'm well aware that that's the case. So Soka.
Looks like Soka to me, but I'll take your word for it.
We're going Soka. Soka, Lateral Strategist. I watched this show. It's amazing how fast the names went out of my head. Soka, Lateral Strategist. 1 Azorius for a 2/4 uncommon with vigilance. Whenever Soka and at least one other creature attack, draw a card. And then Foggy Swamp Spirit Keeper, which is 1 BB for a 2/4 uncommon lifelink. When you draw your second card each turn, create a 1/1 colorless spirit creature token with this token can't block or be blocked by non-spirit creatures. And I think worth talking about both of them together, because I think the biggest feature of both of them is that they are 3-mana 2/4s.
The biggest feature of both of them is that they're engines also.
Like, sure. But engines that can't easily be killed, because there are some other cards that are engine-y, but the fact that this dodges Firebending Lesson and dodges Lightning Strike, both of these cards, is huge, and oftentimes they have good attacks into other things. And Soka in particular is really snowbally. Like, it comes down and the game is immediately about, can you stop this card from attacking? And if the answer is no, like, you know, you're going to be, it's like what you're talking about with Azula. Like, when this card attacks a couple times, it's really hard to beat. Like, you got to buckle down and grind. And that's the other, what you were saying about me with my opponent interacting with me and waving the white flag. The other thing I have to constantly remind myself is I can get 2-for-1 multiple times in this format. And it is okay. Like, you can still win games through getting 2-for-1 two times, three times. But it feels bad. You just have to settle in for the grind.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And I also think cards like these two, and Sokka more specifically, force you to really assess what your role in the matchup is. Because I feel like those have been the times that when you're talking about it's easy to lose games, those are games that I feel like I've easily lost, where like my opponent plays a Sokka, and rather than thinking, like, either I make the misassessment of I'm going to race this and try and beat it, and I'll weather a couple 2-for-1s and try and just kill you before, or I also misassess, no, now is the time for you to buckle down and play the defender so they can't snowball with Sokka. And so these kinds of cards really force you to figure out what your role in the matchup is. Foggy Swamp Spirit Keeper, I feel like the most egregious thing about this Dimir one, this is the 1BB 2/4 lifelink, and whenever you draw your second card each turn, you make a 1/1 colorless spirit creature token that can't block or be blocked by non-spirits. This not being legendary is just ridiculous. The fact that you can get multiples of these on the board and trigger them just really runs away with the game. But just one on its own is also great.
Also, pro safety tip for anybody who has not played the format ad nauseum yet. So these spirit tokens that can only interact with other spirit tokens, Knowledge Seeker, the 1BB 2/1 fox, is a spirit. It's a fox spirit with vigilance. And whenever you draw your second card each turn, it gets a +1/+1 counter and it dies, you get a clue token. That can ambush these 1/1s.
I think also, I guess I don't know all of them, but I just was playing with some spirit tokens and my opponent had the rare Azorius Aang. And that one that has the Waterbend 8 transform, it transforms
into a spirit.
And so, and my opponent didn't get me, but that was because, like, before I attacked, I was just quickly like, quick check, because I know there are non-token spirits in the format.
Yeah. But I think another defining feature, in addition to them being 2/4s, is both of them play offense very well, and they also play defense very well. Like, the stat line and being two-way players, cards that let you shift depending on what the game is asking of you, because the games ask a lot of different things of you in this format. Cards that can do that are very, very good.
Well, the last card on this list also does that. Sun Warriors, the 2RW 3/5 firebending X, where X is the number of creatures you control, and you can pay 5 to make a 1/1 white ally creature token. I mean, obviously you have to attack to get the firebending, so in that way it's not playing defense, but in a way it is, because by virtue of attacking, it's allowing you to make 1/1s. And so it is a two-way player in that sense, and then is also absolutely massive and dodges the removal you've already mentioned.
Yes, for sure. And I think past, you know, these game-defining uncommons, game-defining rares, mythics, I was feeling early on like, well, what's the point if I don't get any of those? But you can win with decks of commons and uncommons. If we talk about Prince or Pauper, Prince being format dominated by rares, mythics, Pauper being commons and uncommons, I would say it's both, like, depending, there are decks of both. There are decks full of, there are Prince decks, there are Pauper decks, for sure. But the Pauper decks can compete with the Prince decks. You just need a very cohesive deck, and it, oftentimes, in my experience, a way to sneak in damage once an opponent stabilized. Like, very common play patterns for me with these common and uncommon decks is get my opponent down to 7 or 8, and then figure out how to cheese the last 7 or 8 points of damage, or go wide enough that I can just flunge and get the last 7 or 8 points of damage in, that sort of thing.
Yes. I think one of the reasons I feel like I would define this format as a Jeskai format. I assume you would too. Like, that would be the wedge that I would put the stamp on. So I got 2 out of the 3 right when I said Esper. Black has fallen quite mightily in my estimation. And I would say that Jeskai can do, specifically, I guess maybe, no, all three of them, blue, red, red, white, and blue, white, can all do this thing that you're talking about, which is be a deck of commons and uncommons that can trophy.
Yes.
I don't think black, I feel much less confident about black decks being able to do that. And I'm not quite sure where I land with green, but I also feel like green is in that space where, like, it kind of needs the juice of higher rarity. And one of green's perks is that it can tie a bunch of those rares together in one deck because of the fixing it provides.
For sure. I would say green-white is another deck that can do it on commons and uncommons. Yeah. But that's more white than it is green, in my opinion. But I mean, we're splitting hairs at that point. But one of the things that these commons and uncommons decks have in common is that they're very synergistic, and they can be pretty explosive. And more importantly, they have good interaction at common. But there are cards that are not quote-unquote good. Like Otter Penguin, I think, is a very good example of this. It's a card I keep going up and up and up on. It's one and a blue for a 2/1. When you draw your second card each turn, it gets +1/+2 and can't be blocked that turn. Otter Penguin is not a good Magic card, like when you put it on Quadrant Theory or something like that. It's not, like, if you're evaluating it in a vacuum, not a good Magic card. And when you compare it to something like Sokka, Lateral Strategist, the 2/4 Vigilance we just talked about, it pales in comparison to that card. But what it does do is it, if you surround it with the right cards, it gives you a strategy and a game plan that can win a game of Magic. And commons that do that for you are very good in this format. Like Otter Penguin has shot up my pick order. I don't think I would be unhappy. I mean, I wouldn't be happy first picking it, but I would be willing to first pick it. And I think if you had told me that 3 days ago, I would have told you were insane. And I'm quite happy like third through fifth picking it or whatever. Once I know that I'm blue, because I know that it's going to give me a way to craft a game plan. And I think there's a lot of cards like that in the commons and uncommons that can be great if you surround them with the right pieces, but if you don't, are truly horrible and you're going to lose quite easily.
Yeah, I mean, if you can consistently turn Otter Penguin on, it's going to be great. If you, I don't know how you end up in a deck where you can't do that. Something went horribly wrong, but if that is true, yeah, Otter, like a 2-mana 2/1 is abysmal in this format. Can we take a quick pause and talk about the power and toughness of 2-drops in this format?
Yes, after we finish this discussion about Otter Penguin. Okay. Because I do think it's possible to end up where Otter Penguin isn't consistently turned on, or even if you can consistently turn it on. You need a couple copies of it. You need ways to protect it. And your deck needs to be, the rest of your deck needs to be able to play offense along with Otter Penguin. Like, just putting in a deck that can draw some cards, it's going to be really bad in that deck.
Right. It can't, it like, I feel like you could look at it and be like, oh, this is like a 2-mana evasive 3-power thing. I'll build a control deck where Otter Penguin is my win con. Like, you can't really do that. That's not going to get you across the finish line.
Correct. But let's talk stats of 2-drops.
So, because I know later on you're saying 2/2s as like a stat line are on notice, and I agree. But I have this, like, I feel like so many power and toughness combinations of 2-drops, I am not happy with. Like 2-mana 2/1s, I really hate currently. I think the Battle Fan is abysmal. We were talking about this on stream yesterday, like, and someone was like, how can it be so bad? Like, it does, and they were just rattling off all the things that you and I thought were gonna make it a golden egg. Like, oh, it's 2 permanents for water bending, it's something to sacrifice, it's this, it's an ally. It's like, yeah, it does all of that. But none of that matters. And so the fact that it does all of that doesn't actually make it flexible or good. So Battle Fan is out.
Agreed. Battle Fan is out because 2/1 doesn't cut it at its baseline. So any of the other things it doesn't do are irrelevant because the base of the card doesn't cut it.
And similar with the Poxbearers, the Orzhov hybrid 2-mana 2/1 that dies into a 1/1. I don't care about that card at all. Like, yeah, will I play it? Yes. But I don't feel that card is impactful. It is like air quotes synergistic in the sac decks or whatever. But I don't like that card myself.
The problem is you don't want to sacrifice your board. Sacrificing your board is actively bad in this format.
Well, it's also really hard to be like, I'm going to get down with playing some 2-mana 2/1s when Forecasting Fortune Teller exists.
Correct.
But it's not like Forecasting, we were talking about this yesterday, but Forecasting Fortune Teller is also not the best common in the set, which is also crazy.
Like, yeah, I mean, Firebending Lesson is the best common in the set. Not close to close. That card is like an A-. It's insane.
Agreed. But like, is Forecasting Fortune Teller worse than Lightning Strike?
Yes.
Which, that I would be, have been a tough sell for me at the start of this format. Like, I was guns a-blazing for Thraben Inspector with an extra point of toughness. But it just doesn't quite... I mean, it's still very good. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm playing as many as I can, but there is a sort of like, sometimes you're like, is this actually like what my deck is trying to do? Like, if you're trying to be super proactive, your 1-3 may not be that good, which is just interesting to think about.
That's the knock against forecasting fortune teller, right? Like, ostensibly, Otter Penguin and fortune teller want to live side by side. And they do, and I have. But there is a bit of tension there in that forecasting fortune teller really doesn't play offense well at all. And that is a bit of a knock against it in this format, because sometimes you do need to play offense early on.
Weirdly, Messenger Hawk is kind of a better friend to Otter Penguin than Forecasting Fortune Teller.
Correct. Much better, I think, because they both want to attack and Fortune Teller doesn't. And the problem with Fortune Teller not attacking is what we were alluding to earlier, which is there's a lot of game defining rares and you can get 2-for-1 multiple times and still win. So if your Forecasting Fortune Tellers aren't pressuring your opponent who has better cards than you, you're going to lose the game to your opponent's better cards. The fortune teller, like, you can make it totally irrelevant.
Yes, totally agree. There's one more thing I wanted to shout out about Otter Penguin. I forget if I said this. I might have said this last week, but it bears repeating. One of the reasons I love Otter Penguin so much is you can bluff attack with it or threat of activation attack with it into opposing 2/2s and 2/3s. Like, you, if you have a clue on board, they just can't block and you just get in for 2 unblockable damage. But even if you don't have a clue, they have to be like, do you have the, is it hybrid tormenting voice variant? Like, do you have a way to instant speed draw cards? It's probably not worth it for me to get blown out. I'll just take the 2. And so Otter Penguin can start chipping in even in those early turns without actually activating it, which is why I think it's so good as well.
Yeah, that is it. Tormenting voice is called Abandon Attachments, for the record.
Thank you. Yeah.
But yeah, and then the other thing that's beautiful about the Otter Penguin, I think this is my favorite card in the format, is once they do that, well, they just take 2 a couple times, then all of a sudden the clock, when you start making it unblockable, goes a lot faster.
Yes, totally agree. Yeah. And if you're adding in a Messenger Hawk in there, like, you can get people dead pretty quickly if they're relying on just hang out on board and wait to draw my bombs.
Yeah. Ode to Otter Penguin. That should be the title of this episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so 2/1s don't cut it. 1/3s don't cut it. 2/2s also don't cut it. I don't like 2/2s either.
That's what I'm saying. Is like, how is that true? How can it be that, like, all of those stat lines where I'm like, because usually it's like, well, 2/1s aren't good because 1/3s are good. And it's like, well, I don't know if 1/3s are that good. Like, forecasting fortune teller is good. But then it's like, yeah, but 2/2s definitely not good because there's 2/3s and 1/3s. It's weird. I don't know. I don't know what stat line I like.
It's very weird. The only 2/2 I really like is the Compassionate Healer, the 1 and a white 2/2 when it becomes tapped, you gain a life and scry 1. That is a 2/2 that I am happy to play. I think that card is quite good. But I want 2-mana 2/3s. Like, anything other than the stupid Simic Platypus.
But, yeah, I was going to say, but I don't want Platypus Bear.
Anything other than that. Like, give me an uncommon, a rare, that's a 2-mana 2/3. That's where it's at. 2-mana 2/3.
Okay, okay. Yeah,
that's honestly, first-time flyer. 2/3s in general. Yeah. So 3-drops that are 2/3s, also very good.
Are they? Like,
yeah. First time, like, flyers, not first time flyers. The glider pilots.
Oh, that's, yeah. Glider kids, the 2/3 scry 1.
Yeah. That card is excellent. And also wall top sentries, if you're interested in slowing the game down. 2 and a green, 2/3 reach death touch when it dies. If there's a lesson card in your graveyard, you gain 2 life. That card is excellent at grinding the game to a halt.
Totally agree. Real sleeper common for green.
Okay, so we've talked 2-drop stats. We've talked common and uncommon deck building considerations. We have talked about playing to the board, but I don't think quite enough. I think playing to the board is crazy important in this format, but not doing it with bad cards.
Right. So I feel like I think this is worth saying, but what I want to ask about or try and dial in on is this different than other sets?
Like, yes. I have not felt the need have creatures. There's not always the pressure to end games that there is in this format. This format puts pressure on you to close the game out sometimes, because there's times where, like, it's the old Mike Sigrist thing or whatever, the old Magic player thing of, let's both turn our decks over and see whose deck is going to win. Like, there's definitely a lot of matchups that have an element of that. Like, that if neither player is clocking the other, the same player is always going to win that matchup over and over and over and over. So I do think this format asks you, even if that's not your deck's default plan, like, your deck's ability to present a clock in some fashion is very important. I think every deck needs to be able to present a clock unless you're the person with all the bombs.
Okay. All right. I think I buy that. I just feel like we oftentimes get ourselves into like, and in this format, flying is good and you have to use removal. And it's like, okay, but just trying to figure out what is the defining feature here? How is it specific to Avatar?
That's I think the specificity of it is that there's so many bomb rares that if you can't present a clock, you're just going to lose more often than in an average format for not playing to the board. You get punished even more than normal.
And when you say you have to get on board with good cards, are you both making, I feel like the distinction is twofold. It is one, a distinction of literal, like, make sure your card evaluation is good and you are not putting bad cards in your deck. Looking at you, corrupt court official, the one in a black 1/1 makes them discard a card. But also synergy pieces. There's like a base level of make sure your card evals are good, but also make sure your card evals are good for like figuring out ways that to boost up cards, to be like, okay, usually I wouldn't play this, but because I have 3 Fire Nation cadets, I want to play these lessons and this is how I'm going to make them good.
Yeah, I agree. The format asks a lot of you in card evaluation, deck evaluation, strategy evaluation. Mm-hmm. And I think in addition to this getting on board early, I think an easy takeaway from this episode that is wrong is, well, let me draft all the Fire Nation cadets. Let me draft all the whatever. Like, I have to do that to engage with the format. And I don't think that's true. Fire Nation cadets is a strategy, but I think Fire Nation cadets and firebending in general has this thing that happens to it where your deck folds on the draw pretty easily to a piece of early interaction if you're all in on attacking. Like, there was a point in time where I was like, okay, there's rares, I want to beat the rares, I'm going to be all in aggressive. And that also I don't think is the answer. I think you want your deck to be able to, you want your cards to be able to play both ways. That's what I have started valuing. And I'm sure that is a truism in Magic always. But again, it's especially important here because you got to be able to pressure. But sometimes you're on the draw, or sometimes your opponent's a faster deck than you, or sometimes your opponent plays Sokka Lateral Strategist or whatever. And you have to be able to adapt roles. And the firebending cards are really bad at switching from I'm the beatdown to I'm not the beatdown. Like, if firebending cards aren't the beatdown, they're woefully underpowered.
I don't think I feel as strongly about firebending specifically as you do in terms of like it can't play defense or it can't win on the draw or can't or like struggles against a firebending lesson or a lightning strike against its 1-drop or 2-drop. But what I do want to hone in on is that sentiment of like, oh, I want to beat my opponent's bomb, so I'm going to draft like this. I think forcing in that way in this format is a recipe for disaster, because I think there are a lot of viable things to do that is dictated by the packs and like just being like, okay, I'm getting the bomb, so I'm going to do this, or I'm getting the synergy pieces in this package, so I'm going to go that way. Like, you can't do the Fire Nation cadets things if those cards aren't going late for you, if you're not getting Fire Nation cadets a little late, if you're not getting the lessons that you want in that deck that are cheap, getting them late or getting them plentifully. Like, you just can't sort of force your way into it because either the bombs aren't there or the synergy pieces aren't there. And you can't fabricate either of those.
I agree. I think that is another defining feature of the format, is that you've got to let whatever the draft is giving you. There's a lot of viable options, and whatever the draft is giving you, that is definitely what you should draft. I think this is very much not a gumption set, a soft forcing set, whatever you want to call it. Like, this is true Ben Stark, let's draft the hard way type draft format. But I will say, I think Fire Nation Cadets in particular is a very nice litmus test for how to engage with the format. And I think there's been a lot of talk on our podcast, feels like in the Twitterverse scuttle, about Fire Nation Cadets. And if you haven't played the format much, it's hard to know when to pick it. Mm. And for me, what I've landed on is I really want to be wheeling Fire Nation Cadets or have a lot of good pieces for them already and then pick them up pack 1, pick 6, pack 1, pick 7, maybe wheel another one. But aggressively picking Fire Nation Cadets is, I think, a recipe for disaster in the format.
I agree. The one time I would think that I could do it, like if you see weak packs, those are times where I'll try to pick cards where I'm like, what is a card that I feel like I can reliably achieve the ceiling of? And so something like Fire Nation Cadets or even Otter Penguin out of weak packs early is a kind of card that I might go like, okay, I know where this can lead me, and so I'll take it. But you have a point later on that is just like the one that I want to be make big and bold, which is when you let packs like that, weak packs, define your draft, that's when you go off the rails. That is when you're going to have a recipe for disaster. And so I'm not saying that I'm giving weight to those picks, but those are the times where I might make those kinds of picks early, is just to be like, ah, it's a weak pack, I'll take this. But I'm not giving weight to it. It's just a sort of, for if it happens, then I already have one in the tank.
Yes, I agree with that for sure. So I think if we're talking format strategies, other defining features of the format, I think, to borrow from Limited Resources, cabs, cards that affect the board state, there's a lot of decks that are cards that affect the board state. And that was where I finally just started paying more attention to stats, because I kept losing to, like, I was playing these red-white decks and I kept losing to green cards that I thought were just hot garbage, but that had power and toughness. Like, my opponents just putting power and toughness on the battlefield and interacting was good for them. There's a lot of decks that are cabs decks that just want stats on the battlefield, want some interaction, and those decks can curb out and win versus the rares if they get ahead. But there's also a lot of synergy decks. There's a lot of multicolored bomb decks. But overarchingly, I think this is another thing, is that there's enough push and pull in different directions in the format, from like going wide to curve outs to synergy to bombs to inevitability for some decks. You cannot play a control deck. You cannot play a reactive deck in this format, or a deck whose primary plan is to be reactive.
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons. The chief among them is that we don't have a cancel variant. The fact that there isn't a like hard counter that is cheap and common makes it hard to feel confident about getting to the late game, because it'll quench you, will not quench you on turn 9 when your opponent plays Azula. Like, you're just going to lose to that. And the Sakka's Haiku is not a good card, in my opinion. I'm not a huge fan of Sakka's Haiku. I think like it's too situational. That's the 5 mana counter a thing, mill 3, draw a card, untap a land. Like, it's just that's a tough ask to, there's not, I don't think, enough to do with your mana at instant speed. We're holding that up and not feeling priced into firing it off on anything is a spot you can be in. So that's not a card I like. So I think that makes it hard for the true control decks to get to the late game.
Yeah, but you do need to be able to interact, I think. So that's mm-hmm. what I said. Proactivity, interactivity. The interaction's good, but the thing I've started to value in my interaction is that I can fire it off when I want to. So for example, Razor Rings is a card I was trying a lot, you know, early on, day 2, which is 1 and a white, deals 4 damage to an attacking or blocking creature, and you gain life equal to the excess damage dealt. That card is great against the aggro decks when it works. It's also really bad when it doesn't do what you need it to do. So I think it compared to Path of Redemption is a card that we were talking about and discussing quite a bit yesterday. I've come way up on Path of Redemption, which is the 1 and a white pacifism, and then you can pay 5 to exile the creature and make a 1-1 ally.
That, a deck that we played yesterday, that we drafted and I played and got to trophy with, I ended up playing 1 Watery Grasp and 1 Path of Redemption. And I believe those were that was the first time I played both of those cards. I'd seen discourse about it in our Discord. I liked Samp's take about like, you want to play like one path, and we should be saying what these cards are. So the path is the 1 and a white aura, enchanted creature. It can't attack or block, and then you can pay 5 at sorcery speed to exile it and make a 1/1 ally. And Watery Grasp is the single blue aura that keeps a thing tapped, and you can pay 5 waterbended to shuffle it into their library. The take that I was seeing was, the take that we had prior was, aura-based removal is abysmal in a world with airbending, which I all still kind of am on board with. But then I was seeing takes of like, if you play one path in your assertive decks or one watery grasp in your, you know, more reactive decks or more grindy decks, that's okay. And I was starting to come around to that. And the point you made yesterday, which I liked, is that some of the firebending stuff, you don't want it to get an attack. And that's where Razor Rings, I mean, sometimes they have something that has 5 toughness and then Razor Rings really doesn't cut it. But when you're like, I don't really want you to get your 2 red mana and your clue, but I can't stop it from happening because I have Razor Rings, it's tough. You do kind of sometimes want to stop things from being able to engage in combat.
Yes. And I think a lot of the cards that snowball do want to attack. Sokka, for example.
Sokka, like,
there's,
yeah.
There's a lot of good cards that... And so I think the other thing I want to try to sell you on Path to Redemption for, which I've come way up on it. I think I'm pretty actively interested in playing it in white decks now, certainly over Razor Rings, is that I value firing it off when I want to. I value it stopping things from attacking or blocking, and all the downsides, all the airbending downsides, all the waterbending downsides. I think that's minor enough that it doesn't matter, because you can get 2-for-1, and it doesn't really matter that much. It's possible to win through getting 2-for-1 a couple times. And so if you're able to stop the thing for however long you're able to stop it for when you want to, I think that's, and sometimes you don't get 2-for-1 and then it's awesome. Like it's a very, you know what I mean? Like yeah. Then it's insanely good. But even if you stop it for a couple turns and then you get airbended and then they replay it, you know what I mean? Like it stopped it when you needed to stop it. And stopping things when you need to stop them is really valuable in this format, I think.
This is like, we haven't had a card like this in a while, but it's probably a card that like week 3, I'm going to come to the pod and be like, you're right. I like Path a lot. Like I'm not quite there yet, but I can feel myself inching towards it.
Okay. So let's talk gameplay. And we already have been talking gameplay, but I think it's really complex. I think it's really difficult. I think the games are swingy. You got to be ready to handle those swings. Like you need to buckle down. And I think just recognize that this is always true in Magic, that whatever, some percentage of games are just going to be unwinnable. 30, yeah, sure. But the unwinnable ones here feel way worse than in other formats. Like, you just have, like, literal no chance due to some of the synergy curve outs or due to some of the rares. And I think, like, just having a strong mental game and making sure that you're ready to take the beating and get back on the horse and keep trying is really important.
Yeah, I think that's good advice.
I think the format feels similar to 1 in some senses to me, and it's got very strict rules of engagement. On the play, I've tried very hard to at least have a 3-drop. That's my rule for myself on the play. If I'm on the play and I have a 3-drop, I'm good. If I'm on the draw and a 3-drop is my first play, I'm probably mulliganing that hand. Not all the time. If I've got some other good heavy hitters to follow that up, and I'm pretty confident I'm going to hit land drops. But generally, if I'm on the draw with a 3-drop, that's where I'm like, I really need to start thinking hard about mulliganing at this point.
Yeah.
We've talked about Fire Nation Cadets. I think this is such a format-defining card, and I'm less interested in playing it at this point. I don't know. It sounds like you don't feel that way about it, or more than that it's not something I'm actively seeking out. There was a point where I was like, okay, gotta be fast. Need to get those Fire Nation Cadets, need to turn them on. And I'm much more patient, I think, which I think is another big thing this format asks of you in both the draft and in the gameplay. Mm-hmm. Pack one, like, you don't need to shove your curve low in pack one. Like, you need to take good cards in pack one, because you're always going to be able to pick up curve fillers at common. And you do need to probably play curve fillers at common, or you're hoping not to, but doing that early in the draft, I don't think is right.
But and to your point, like, or to underline that with the point I made last week about feeling like I really wanted to read signals, because the card quality drops off a cliff. And if you can't get those pack fillers, if you're fighting over whatever you're doing with other people, and on the wheel, the pack fillers or the deck fillers are in other colors, it's horrible. But if you can get stuff on the wheel that goes into your deck and fills a hole, whether it's in the curve or in synergy, that's really powerful. So that's where I'm just still like, just be patient in that draft, especially in pack one, and try and figure out where you're supposed to go. I agree with you totally. Like, that's my feeling about Fire Nation Cadets, is I like it as a strategy. I don't think it's the be all end all. And I don't think it's the only, like, it's a flavor of red, white, or red, blue.
Correct.
Like, not all red, white, or red, blue decks are going to take advantage of Fire Nation Cadets.
Correct. Yeah. Okay, last thought here on gameplay, which I think is another gripe about the format for me, in addition to the swings. This is another thing I don't like about this format. And another reason I honestly didn't like OG Innistrad that much with the werewolves mechanic, it's very difficult to recover from stumbling in this format. And I think like, you just need to know that going in. Like, missing your land drop, you're probably going to lose. Like, even for a turn. It's very difficult to come back from stumbling on mana or stumbling on colors, and then just to know to mulligan more aggressively, potentially, if that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Navigating drafts. Speaking of patience, there are so many bad packs in this format.
Yes.
Like just packs that are totally empty. Even if you're doing the right thing for your seat, like you're just gonna see packs that are atrocious. And you just need to be okay with that. And I, since I have come to that realization, I feel much better about drafting the format. I was getting frustrated with that a lot in the first couple of days I was playing.
So this was the pack one, pick one I had from the draft that we did yesterday, where you were like, hey, do you want to join me on stream? And I was like, yes, but first you have to draft this deck with me because I just fired a draft. So here's the pack. The commons that I'll shout out are Abandoned Attachments. The one is it hybrid. You may discard a card if you do draw two cards. Yuyan Archers, one on a red 3/1 reach. When it enters, you may discard a card if you do draw a card. Merchant of Many Hats, one on a black 2/2. Pay two and a black to return it from your graveyard to your hand. In the uncommons, we have Judy, one of many, one on a black 2/2. Pay black, tap, surveil one, create a token that's a copy of this, then sack an artifact or creature at sorcery speed. There's Appa, Loyal Sky Bison, 4WW, 4/4 flyer. Whenever Appa enters or attacks, you choose one. You give something flying or airbend to target non-land permanent you control. And the rare is Avatar Destiny, 2GG, aura, enchant creature you control. Enchanted creature gets +1/+1 for each creature card in your graveyard and blah, blah, blah. It's not good or playable. This pack is abysmal.
It's really bad. But it's going to be really bad for everybody. Like, eight people are going to see that. It's going to be horrible for all eight people.
Right. And so you would love there to be one good card that you could be like, I'll hang my hat on that, and then everybody else gets the dregs. But no, everybody's getting dregs from here. So when you see this pack, I think there are two things that are important to do. One is, again, I love your piece of advice here, which is do not make draft-defining decisions from bad packs.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest traps in the format. Completely cosigned. My own take.
And then the other thing you want to do is, I think, either pick cards that are have the most likelihood, like are the most flexible. So whether that's hybrid mana or it's a lesson, you're giving a pump to that, or you, something you particularly like or feel like is open. Like, I've been drafting white aggro a lot, so I'll take Yip Yip out of this pack, whatever. So make informed picks out of bad packs, but don't give weight to those picks as the draft progresses.
Yeah, you're going to take a card, hope it makes your deck, but you're treating the next pack as pack one, pick one.
Correct. Yep.
And we took what? I think Abandoned Attachments, right?
Yeah, we took Abandoned Attachments. And it ended up making the deck. But,
yes.
You know, we don't know if that's going to be true. That card is just, I mean, lessons... You are certainly, if you are in either blue or red, which Abandoned Attachments is, like, you are just likely to care about lessons in some way, which is, I think, why that card is so good.
Correct. I think one of the things the drafts ask you to do, which is hard, is balancing power versus balancing synergy, which is difficult because I think the synergy is really good in the format and can compete with the rares, but a medium synergy is really bad. Compared to the decks with good rares or the decks with good synergy. Like, so not getting there, like trying to go for synergy and not getting there all the way is really rough.
So can we talk about what you mean by that versus last week we were sort of, I think, championing pockets of synergy, like having like little packages in your deck. Do you still feel like that's good? And if so, how is that different than not getting there on synergy or halfway getting there on synergy?
Yeah, I think pockets of synergy is still fine because to me, pockets of synergy is then you've prioritized in the draft. For me personally, with how I'm drafting, I've prioritized, okay, I want cards with good stats. I want cards that can play offense and defense well. I want cards that can pressure my opponent when it's necessary to pressure my opponent. If I've gone all in on synergy, for example, like what comes to mind to me is like Fire Nation Cadets and trying really hard to turn those on and then not quite getting there on enough lessons to turn it on. Or similarly, like Fire Nation Cadets first time flyer, like that's a flavor of blue red. I think that can be very good, but you also need the lessons. And if you don't get a real density of lessons, like 7 or 8, it's tough. And you don't want to be playing bad lessons to turn those cards on either, because that's also, I think, a recipe for disaster when you
have cards that care about lessons. And you're like, well, I guess I'm going to have to play this lesson that I don't really want to play to try to get my lesson count up to seven lessons for my Fire Nation cadets or whatever. Like, that's not a high. You need firebending lesson. You need like three firebending lessons for that deck to be great, which is why that deck doesn't always come together, because firebending lesson is in high demand. Or Otter Penguins without enough ways to draw to, or that sort of thing. Or maybe you've got a plan where you want to push damage and you don't see enough of, what's the name of it? Deserter's Disciple. One in red for the 2/2 that can make something power two or less unblockable. Some red decks really want that card because your plan is to make something unblockable and then pump it and do whatever. And there's been times I'm like, okay, I'm going to wheel a couple Deserter's Disciples. And then they don't wheel and you're like, great, my deck does stone nothing now, or it's gonna be way harder for my deck to cheese wins. That's kind of what I mean by synergy stuff not coming together. And then you're just playing a bunch of low powered cards compared to everybody else playing higher powered cards than you.
Yeah, I feel like that also like is a byproduct of, I mean, I don't know what those drafts were like for you, but when you're talking about like trying to wheel a Deserter's Disciple and then it doesn't, that probably means you shouldn't be in that deck.
Correct. Yeah. But I mean, you're there, and then at that point, it's not much to be done about it if you're expecting it to wheel and it doesn't. Yeah. I think one of the other defining features of drafts to me, and I think this is the thing that has helped me more than I mean, both of the things you were talking about, the draft defining decisions from bad packs, that's a big trap. But trying to, in addition to feel out what colors are open for my seat, try to think bigger picture. What strategies are available to my seat? Am I seeing commons and uncommons that can pressure or sneak in damage? Am I seeing the Otter Penguins? Am I seeing the Deserter's Disciples? Am I seeing good mid-range cards? Should I just sign up to play a mid-range deck that's going to crush the aggro decks and maybe lose to some rares? Am I seeing a density of lessons? Like, do I expect to be able to turn on lessons matter cards or not? I think that's one of the bigger questions for me during the draft, because I think that's another fail case in drafts, is that like, you get cards that really want you to have lessons and you don't see the good lessons. That's something I've felt a bit of tension in the drafts, where I want to take lessons payoffs highly, but lessons are in high demand. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the hardest one for me to navigate currently, but just trying to feel out those broad strokes in addition to what colors I'm trying to read.
Yeah. I feel like Fire Nation Cadets and First Time Flyers are both such interesting examples, because they're cards where it's like, if I get lessons, this card's going to be great. If I don't get lessons, this card is terrible.
But yet they're also not even that good when you get lessons. There's such a risk-reward tension there.
Yeah, Cadets more so than First Time Flyers, I think, is better. But yes, I agree.
But even something like Boomy, King of Three Trials, which is the 5 and a green 4/4 that then you get a stack up for each lesson you have in the graveyard, Scry 3, Earthbend 3, put 3 plus almost 1 counters on him. I don't like picking that card and then assuming I'm going to get 3 lessons.
No.
But a lot of times if you're spending the picks highly on lessons, you don't always get the lessons payoffs. But generally where I've landed is that I want to go aggressively after the lessons and then pick the payoffs when I know I'm going to have the lesson density count. Doesn't always work that way. Like, you're obviously going to pick Ran and Shaw, which is the 3 red dragon that wants you to have 3 lessons and then just super prioritize lessons after that.
Right. Yeah. So they're not all created equal. But I do feel like mostly my feeling with that is I want to be just playing good lessons. Like, I want to be playing good cards. And if those cards are lessons, great. Then once I have those, I will take lessons payoffs. Like, I think that is the responsible order to be doing those things. Sometimes the reverse happens, where like, if you do get, you know, I played a deck the other day where I had 3 or 4 Fire Nation Cadets, and then I was playing the Dai-Li, I forget, the one in a black, like Thoughtseize card, which is a lesson, which is a card I never thought I would play, but I was like, I actually do want to be able to go Cadets on 1, Thoughtseize you on 2, and then get my firebending online. But I don't want to be like taking Dai-Li whatever and then hoping, sure, I get lessons payoffs.
Correct. That's one of the reasons abandoned attachments is good, which is the is it hybrid lesson tormenting voice variant. It's right at the level of you're fine to play it no matter what. And then if you care about lessons, you're like, okay, I'm really in on this card. But it also, that is your turn two play, feels horrible.
Yes.
It's very much a double spell on turn 5 type card.
And ideally, like, I mean, also, it's one of the things where you double spell on turn five, or hopefully you're just using your firebending mana on it.
Yeah. That too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into some decks. The pillars of the format, as it were. So I think the prime, pillar prime, is Jeskai tempo decks.
Yes. All three of these color combos are excellent, I think.
Yeah. So blue-red really truly lessens tempo. There's a lot of different flavors of it. Like, it can be red Fire Nation Cadets. It can be blue Otter Penguin. It can be blue-red just good lessons payoffs. There's a lot of flavors, but ultimately, all of these decks want to pressure, chip in damage, figure out a way to close out the game, and Lightning Strike has been a premium one. I have Lightning Striked a lot of people out of this format, and have started thinking, okay, I really don't want to get down to six so that two Lightning Strikes can kill me or whatever against the red decks.
100% agree.
Red-white aggro, which I think is just more straightforward red-white aggro than it does usually care about lessons. I think that's a red-white's a tough place for Fire Nation Cadets.
Yeah, and I feel then, like red-white can be Fire Nation. Like, Fire Nation Cadets is its own deck. And whether you are red-white, red-blue, red-black, maybe, I don't think you can do it in red-green. But, like, that's a deck. But then mostly I think red-white aggro is more base-white allies.
Correct.
With some allies red go support.
Wide. Yeah. Red-white, I would say, is truly, as WotC build it, allies go wide. Yeah. And then blue-white, tempo flyers. That one's great. Blue White, I think, is my favorite deck in the format right now. I think it's very interactive, can be proactive, can be defensive. I think it checks all those boxes that I want of plays offense and defense well. And then even though this category is called Jeskai Tempo Decks, I think Red Black Aggro probably gets lumped in here. Although that's really just Red Aggro to me because Black is pretty atrocious in my opinion.
I agree. Yeah.
But it does have some banger rares. Like, yeah. You're going to play black. Like, you shouldn't be, if black's open, you should be willing to draft black because you're going to probably get some banger rares.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm drafting in terms of like signal reading. And so I have drafted black decks, sometimes even without the busted rares, because sometimes you just have to. That's what is open for your seat. But that is the spot I am least excited to be in, because without the rares, blacks on commons and commons don't really deliver, in my opinion.
Correct, yeah. That takes us on to mid-range decks, which are, in my opinion, green-white allies as the best of them. And then green-black earthbending, which can do the thing. Green-black really beats up on red-white. It's embarrassingly easy to win against red-white when you're playing green-black. And then green-red, I think, also falls in this category. And as another one that really, your stuff's just bigger than red-white stuff. And it's very difficult for them to win with firebending lessons and lightning strikes because you're packing four fours.
Okay, yep.
And then late-game decks, which are, I think, fewer and farther between, unless you've got rares. So there's blue-black, which definitely like plays to the board early. You know, you got your defensive speed and then you're winning with card advantage later. And then green, splish splash, all the rares, whatever. I think those are the two premium late game decks, but you need to make sure that you're likely to win the let's flip our decks over and see who has better cards contest if you're signing up to go to the late game willingly.
Especially in the green-based multicolor good stuff decks, you not only need to make sure you have, I mean, it's a classic, the recipe for those kinds of decks, which is make sure you have the cards that like the good bombs to incentivize you to be in that deck. Make sure your mana is good, but also really make sure you have cheap interaction. So whether your secondary color is red because you got three firebending lessons and a lightning strike, or white and you're packing some razor rings and a path and a whatever the uncommon lesson that kills an attacking creature, like, whatever, you just have to make sure your secondary color is packing cheap interaction, because that's how you're not going to fold to those Jeskai decks.
Well, cheap interaction and also, I think, cheap creatures that can attack and block. I've never wanted that more than in this format, because even if you're in the mirror and you get in whatever 8 points of damage before you get to the mid game or the late game or whatever, it limits what your opponent can do against you so much and gives you more wiggle room to turn the corner against their rares. I don't love a deck whose plan is to only interact early.
Okay.
I just think creatures that attack and block, you got to pack interaction too, but I think a classic recipe for decks that want to go late, which is let me have all my cheap cards be interaction and then haymakers. I don't think that's a great recipe in this format. I think you need cheap interaction, a reasonable curve of creatures in your 2 and 3 drop slot too, and then packing your haymakers.
Okay. What are those cards though for the green decks?
As far as creatures?
Yeah, what are the creatures that you're happy to attack and block with early? I guess Rebellious Captives.
I mean, Rebellious Captives much. Which is the 1 and a green 2/2 Earth Exhaust 6 to put 2+1 counters on it in Earthbend 2. By the time you have the exhaust ability available to you, if you're not doing better things, you're losing. Yeah. And the 2 mana 2/2 doesn't cut it. I think Raucous Audience is okay. Like it ramps you and then can attack and block in a pinch. Don't love the 2/1 stat line, but that's...
I prefer Raucous Audience in the mid-range decks because those, like when you get to go 2-drop ramper into 4-drop on turn 3, like when you're playing a 4/4 on turn 3, that puts a lot of decks in a pinch.
I agree.
So I feel like I like that even more in the mid-rangey decks than in the late-game decks.
Sure. But I think building your late-game decks more like a mid-range deck. Yeah. Sure. Then happen to have the bombs is a better recipe than cheap interaction plus bombs and nothing in the middle.
Okay.
Which is a more classic recipe. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. So there's more bleed between the kinds of, or more overlap in the kinds of cards you want for both of those decks in this format. I'm with you.
Yeah. And for example, Toph is a great one, which I mean, it's just a great card, but Toph the Blind Man at 2 and a green, *3, enters Earthbend 2, has power equal to the number of counters on lands, wall top sentries, 2 and a green, 2/3, reach death touch, that can attack, that can block. Those are the main ones, but you're going to get cards from other colors too. And I think rather than it being specific cards, it's more the concept of I don't want the classic late game deck recipe of only early interaction and then only haymakers. Because you lose the ability to pressure. And I think the ability to pressure is really important in this format.
I did have a deck where like red was absurdly open. I got like, I think 3 Firebending Lessons, 3 Iroh's, whatever, the uncommon
demonstration,
weapon, 2 Lightning Strikes. But the whole time I was like, what am I doing with all of this?
Right. Yeah.
Like, how am I gonna win games? Like, because if I have to feel priced in to go fire off removal, fire off removal, fire off removal, eventually something's going to stick. And that is what happened with that deck. So I feel what you're saying here.
Also, we should talk about the monocolored decks or the heavy colored decks. Those are definitely a thing. I think mono red, mono white are the best of them. I've played heavy green with the green earthbending lesson. It was very good that earthbends equal the number of forests you have. I think blue also, I've lost to a very good mono blue deck. I haven't played mono blue deck. I think the only one that is like probably not great is mono black. Like the Gator's good, but it is not good enough to sign up to only play black cards, in my opinion.
No. God, the black cards are so bad.
Black cards are tough. So you should be on the lookout for those. I think they're definitely a thing. They're definitely real. I've done it. You've done it. We've played against them. And it's cool that those are part of the format.
And both true mono color and also like 12/5 as your mana base split, which I think we're also lumping in as near mono color in this category.
Correct. Yeah. And then decks to avoid, white black is a really tough ask for me currently. It really wants the game to go long, but it doesn't have good reasons for the game to want to go long.
I put so many cards on our like cards I'm down on list, which are like the two. Like they're not signposts, but the 2 uncommons, Judy, one of many, which lets you like make copies of it when you sacrifice stuff, and June Bounty Hunter, which is unblockable when you've drawn a second card and can turn creatures into clues. They're both 2 mana 2/2s, which, sorry, G guards out there, but that doesn't cut it.
2 mana 2/2s are so bad.
They're so mopey. And Tolls of War, the signpost uncommon, the white black enchantment. Makes a clue when it enters, and whenever you sack a permanent on your turn, you make a 1/1 ally. This ability triggers only once each turn. The thing this, like, first of all, there's no spot on the curve where you want to play this card. Like, ostensibly, you're like, I want to play this on 2 so that I get, like, all of my future sacrifice triggers it, but it's not happening. And just, like, later on, the clue and the ally don't matter. I wonder if this could have been good if it made the unblockable spirits instead.
Ooh, yeah.
But even then, I think it's too small ball. Like this card, Tolls of War, is just really bad. And I think black-white is, one of my least favorite, if not my money for worst deck in the format.
Can I surprise you with some data here?
What are you doing right now? What's your goal? What's your
content, baby? Content is my goal always.
Uh-huh.
The third highest game in hand win rate in the format, uncommon, Tolls of War.
That can't be true.
It is. It's
how it's
Foggy Swamp Spirit Keeper, then Sokka Lateral Strategist, and then Tolls of War, baby.
Are those of the multicolored cards? Or just
no,
of all
I just
the,
I'm just
of
filtering
all
by
the all uncommons?
I mean, no. There are monocolored cards in there. But like when you've
How far down are we talking?
I mean, Tolls of War is like a top 20 uncommons.
That is astonishing to me.
And it's the third highest of all the multicolored ones.
That is.
I was also surprised, but that was the one thing I was like, oh, okay, maybe I'm missing something here. But also the really funny thing that happened to me with the data is I don't check it until right before we record this episode. And then I was looking at the decks, you know, like the color pair win rates. And I was like, this doesn't seem right at all. Like, this doesn't line up with my experience. Like, I was expecting to see Jeskai at the top, you know, and it was like green, blue, black. And I was like, what is happening? And
you were looking at a different set.
Was looking at a different set. I hadn't opened it since Edge of Eternities and was still on the edge. I thought it auto updated when a new set came out and I was still looking at Edge of Eternities deck data.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well, maybe I'm wrong about Tolls of War. I guess let us know in the comments or let us know in Discord if you're a patron. Like, what am I missing about this card? Because it seems abysmal to me.
I agree. That's where I'm at on it also. Okay. Individual cards that we're coming around on. We've talked about Path of Redemption. I'm a big champion of that card at this point. Talked about most of these already. Watery Grasp we haven't talked about much, which is the single blue enchantment aura. Enchanted creature doesn't untap during its controller's untap step. You waterbend 5, enchanted creature's owner shuffles it into their library. I think the thing that stands out to me about this is that your mana is precious in the early turns, and this being one mana is worth the drawbacks of potentially getting 2-for-1, potentially getting airbended, etc. Well, I don't like this one as much as Path to Redemption because the creature has to be tapped before it does the thing. But also, my opponent fired this off on my Otter Penguins early yesterday, and I was like, that stinks. Like, because I didn't really want to attack with it, you know? Stop my Otter Penguins from attacking for 4 turns or 5 turns or whatever. So I think that the one mana is worth the drawbacks. It's still not a great card, but I'm much more willing to play it than I was previously. The other nice thing about this is if you do stick it on an Earthbended land, the land is locked down.
Yeah, that is brutal when you get to do that.
So I think that's a very high vote. Like, there's some upsides to Watery Grasp as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I've come up on both Path and Watery Grasp this week.
Land Cyclers. Just want to touch base on where we're at. I'm a big believer in the fish, the giant koi, as we talked about yesterday while we were streaming together, which is the 4 blue 5/7 can become unblockable if you waterbend to 3. That card ends some games.
I totally agree. I am much more inclined to run that card when I have copies of Octopus Form in my deck. The single blue lesson target creature gets +1/+1 and gains hexproof until end of turn. Untap it. Just because then I'm like, oh, wait till I have 7 mana and make sure I have Octopus Form up. Because it's worth the versions of tapping out for that and then it gets got by something is really bad. But the versions of it where you tap out for it, they try and get it, and you can protect it is great. I think of the Land Cyclers, the Koi is far and away the best one. But none of these cards really matter, in my opinion.
I have lost a surprising amount of games to the green, the blue, and the black ones. There are some portion of games where those play out as the relevant thing at the end of games. And it's not a lot. It's like 10% or whatever. But it's enough to make me start wondering, am I supposed to be including them in place of a 17 land when I'm in those colors? The blue one, I'm actively looking to find a way to slot into my deck. The green and the black, I'm questioning. The red and the white, I am not interested in.
Anytime my opponent cycles them,
you feel great. You feel great.
I fist pump. And that makes me think these cards that don't matter.
Are bad. Yeah.
And your inclination to cut lands for them, I think, is truly a little bit of a, you need to check yourself. Because
wow.
Do you want to cycle giant koi?
I don't want to cycle giant koi. I want to cast it. I would just like it to be noted that mythic number 7 conceded to our giant koi. Conceded. Yeah,
that'll go down in history.
It will. Giant koi. What a win. Foggy Swamp Vinebender is another one. This is 3 and a green, 4/3. I just want a gut check on this. Creature can't be blocked by creature's power 2 or less, and you can waterbend 5, put a plus 1 counter on this creature, activate only during your turn. This card's been consistently good against me, and once it was good against me enough, I was like, all right, I'll start playing it. And then once I started playing it, it was good for me, too.
Wow. I have not seen the card on the battlefield, truth be told.
Really?
Yeah, wow. I haven't seen it. But I buy it. Especially, like, the Boros decks can't chump it.
That's the thing. Yeah, the Boros. Yeah. And it's got 3 toughness, so, like, it blocks 2/2s. It's large. Like, this is another one that if you curb, like, accelerate it out on turn 3, it's like a problem. That dies the lightning strike. Don't love that about it.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's a lot to like.
Okay.
Boomerang Basics on this list. Blue Sorcery Lesson. Return target non-land permanent to its owner's hand. If you control that permanent, draw a card. What a card.
Yeah, I played this. I picked it at your behest yesterday during this draft. Kept it in the deck. Despite we didn't really have a ton of like lessons matter stuff in the deck. But it's just to your point about Watery Grasp, 1 mana interaction, even at sorcery speed, is really good in this format.
It's really good. I had a very interesting pick on stream of this versus the blue rare land, which can let you loot for 2 and a blue. And I was like, I don't know. I was going to pick the land. And then ultimately I picked Boomerang Basics. I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so.
It's close. But Boomerang Basics is really good.
I've got to check in on Crashing Wave. Blue sorcery is an additional cost to cast.
That's all recent episode discussion is Crashing Wave card evaluation in our Discord.
It's just people sharing screenshots like, yep, hey, it was good again. So this is the blue sorcery, additional cost, waterbend X, tap up to X target creatures, then distribute 3 stun counters among tapped creatures your opponents control. I've not cast this card myself yet, but I've had it cast against me multiple times, and I have not enjoyed it being cast against me any of those times, which I think is a mark of a card to be on watch for.
I've cast it once, and it was my opponent's copy that I cast with a Hama, and it was very nice to cast it. Felt good after having it cast against me. I think if you check the boxes of your blue deck as proactive, you're interested in playing this card.
You should be checking that box after
you should be checking that box.
Episode.
Yeah.
Octopus Form, I just love. This is the single blue protection spell. And I wanted to shout out How to Start a Riot, 2 and a red instant lesson. Target creature gains menace until end of turn, and creature's target player controls get +2/+0 until end of turn. In the red lessons matter decks, I think this card is actively good.
Yeah, red, white, and red, blue both probably want a copy of this. Red, white sometimes wants multiple copies.
Yeah, exactly my thought as well.
Cards we're down on, 2/2s. Anything that doesn't block well is on notice, and 2/2s don't block well.
What is the stat line, though? Like, what stat line do I want?
2/3. I want 2/3s. 2/3s, 3/3s, 2/4s.
Yeah. And Forecasting Fortune Teller, don't get us wrong. The card is good. Still very happy to play as many of those as I can get. But, you're not, huh?
Yeah. I'm just not trying to get as many as I can get. It's a real, I asked you, I floated this to you yesterday while you were streaming. I think I'm on Otter Penguin over Fortune Teller.
That seems crazy to me, but maybe, again, that could be something where in 2 weeks I say I'm coming around to it. It's just that like Forecasting Fortune Teller is such good friends. It's not as good friends as the Hawk, but such good friends as with the Penguin.
But the thing that I keep coming back to is, like, is Forecasting Fortune Teller a better card? Absolutely. Does it crush Quadrant Theory? Absolutely. But a deck full of 3 Forecasting Fortune Tellers is not a plan.
Yeah, it's kind of like
does not a plan have. And a deck full of 3 Otter Penguins is like, yeah, I know what my deck is trying to do.
That's such an interesting distinction, because it does feel like the 3 Forecasting Fortune Tellers deck is the same as like my, all right, 3 Firebending Lessons and 4 right. Arrows, whatever.
Like, you're not happy if you're spending 2 mana to crack clues. Like, go ahead, knock yourself out. I will steamroll you with 4/4s and your 1/3 that's 2/1 me, quote unquote, 2 times. Like, it's so easy to overcome that.
That's such a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Otter Penguin better than Fortune Teller.
I mean, it is not a better Magic card. I think for this specific format, I feel better having otter penguins.
All of that stuff, those like dichotomy shifts that we're talking about, man, I really like this format right now.
I do also. I think this is a very good format. I think, like I said, it's not necessarily for me. It's a little swingy for my taste, but certainly complex, certainly difficult, like rewards. I think the thing that I appreciate about it most is that I think it is going to reward a deep format knowledge. Surface level, it's going to be very easy to blame variants, very easy to blame bombs, very easy to blame whatever. But I think if you know what's up, I think it does reward deep format knowledge and really tight drafting gameplay, which, I mean, what more can we ask for? That was when I was like, okay, I got to check myself. After I realized those things about it, I was like, if I don't want that from Magic format, what do I want? You know?
There you go. Okay, great.
All right. No time for a draft, right?
No time for a draft.
No time for a draft.
Yeah, you gotta come to Lords Unlimited if you want to draft.
or check out our streams. We've got drafts available there if you want to see us drafting that are on the VODs. All right. Anything else? I feel like we left it out on the field. I'm really excited about this episode and to podcast more about this format. I think it is deep.
Yeah, that's the other thing that just feels good is I'm like, I've like breathed a sigh of relief of like, I'm happy to talk about Cube, happy to do a Q&A, but I'm also just like, I feel like we've got our hands full over the next month or so with this set.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Great place to wrap us up. Thank you as always to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all our content at lordsoflimited.com. We've got links to our tier list is up there, baby. Otter Penguin above Forecasting Fortune Teller. When you can find that on the tier list. You can also find our episode backlogs, our YouTube channel, our Twitch streams, our merch, our Patreon page, all at lordsoflimited.com.
Yeah, they're currently both C pluses. I could be convinced to move Otter Penguin to a B minus. You don't have to twist my arm.
I won't. I won't be twisting your arm to do that. That'll be all you, buddy.
If you got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
The worst part about this is I'm not going to get Otter Penguins as late anymore. It's going to feel bad.
You've
Appreciate it. See y'all later.
What an insane way to end the episode.
What are you going to do? I just say what I felt.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.